So, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to start now while you are still enjoying your delicious JCC lunch. Again, we appreciate you very much coming out for the JCC Lunch and Learn program. Let me just give you a little background into the genesis of this project. Barbara invited me to have a look at a special Haggadah, a Passover Haggadah, that was more of a quote-unquote feminist Haggadah, and I looked through it, and although it wasn't quite my cup of tea personally as an Orthodox rabbi, it contained beautiful, beautiful quotes from all over the Torah, both the oral and written Torah. It was something just gorgeous. And I said to Barbara, well, it could be that the actual lady Seder that you have is not quite my territory, but I would love to give a class using many of these same sources because they're gorgeous. They're worthy of a class. And then Barbara and I were brainstorming, and I said, well, what about a class trying to put to rest the old criticism of traditional Judaism that somehow the ladies are excluded from the Bible, from the Torah. Now, we're not going to today talk about practical Jewish law. We're going to explore the thesis of, does the Torah, does the Bible really discriminate against women? We're going to explore it from a biblical perspective, meaning the 24 books of what we call the Torah, Shebichtav, the written law, as opposed to modern day practice. So what I would like to propose is that not only does our Torah, our Bible, not discriminate against women, but as they say in Yiddish, pumfakeret. It's the opposite is true. It's that because of you wonderful ladies and the ladies of Jewish history that we are here today to learn and celebrate not only the Passover holiday, which is just a week or so away, but all the great holidays, because the survival of our people is really not a man-centric, a patriarchal miracle. I would say it is a matriarchal miracle, as we're going to try to show today. So what I'd like to do is begin with some of the matriarchs and patriarchs of the Jewish people. We know that we have founding fathers and mothers. At the end of the Haggadah, we have the Echa Miyodea, who knows one, and we have the Shlosha Avot, Arba Imahot, the three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and the four matriarchs, Sarah, Rivka, Rebecca, Rachel, Rachel, Vilea. So we have the four matriarchs. And I believe that the beginnings in the Torah of where the ladies start to take the initiative in shaping the future of the Jewish people, us. The first time it happens, have a look at source number one. Sarah and Abraham were childless for 90 years on behalf of Sarah and 100 years on behalf of Abraham in terms of a child together. Remember, they had Ishmael, but that was through the Egyptian princess Hagar. That was not Sarah's child. And after Isaac, Yitzchak, our own patriarch, becomes a reality, Sarah notices that Ishmael is not a good influence on the young Isaac. And she confronts her beloved husband, Abraham, Avraham Avinu, our patriarch Abraham, and says, you know, Abraham, you need to get rid of Ishmael from the house. He is an evil influence on Isaac, and he could be injurious to Isaac down the road. And she says to him the following. This is source number one coming to us from Genesis 21. And Sarah said to Abraham, drive out this handmaid, Hagar, and her son Ishmael. For the son of this handmaid shall not inherit with my son, with Isaac. That's already, of course, a future Jewish people versus the Arab nations, who will inherit the land of Israel. So literally, these are topical issues ad hayom hazeh, until this very moment, as we are all tragically aware of what's going on in the Middle East today. But the matter greatly displeased Abraham, because Abraham, by his nature, was Mr. Chesed, Mr. Kindness. And the idea of driving out his own son, it was antithetical to everything that Abraham lived life for. And therefore, he was upset. So, guess what happened? God steps in and says, you know, Abraham, sorry, but on this occasion, as wonderful as you are, as great a human being, you want to judge your own son, Ishmael, favorably, you better listen to your wife, Sarah, because what she said to you concerning Isaac and Ishmael is absolute, unequivocal truth. Emet. And so God intervenes on behalf of Sarah and says to Abraham, be not displeased concerning the lad, the Nar, and concerning your handmaid. No. Whatever Sarah tells you, hearken to her voice. For in Isaac will be called your seed. Not Ishmael, Isaac. So this is the very first moment, I believe, where the Jewish women are given the ultimate vote of confidence from our Creator. Shema Bikola. Listen to her voice. Not just when it comes to this local conflict, whether or not Hagar and Ishmael are going to stay or go. No. It's much more universal in its application of to the future of the Jewish people. He's saying, God is, to Abraham, listen to the wife. She knows better than you when it comes to the family. She's the decision maker going forward. Shema Bikola. You better listen to her very, very carefully. And this is the, I believe, the first salvo, if you will, on behalf of God in defense of the Jewish mother, the Eshet Chayil, the woman of valor. Who, of course, Abraham writes this beautiful poem for his Sarah upon her departure from this world as a eulogy to memorialize her, and that Solomon, King Solomon, writes it down in the book of Proverbs many generations later. So the quintessential Jewish mother is Sarah. But it doesn't stop there. Let's skip to the next generation. We know that Isaac and Rivka have something that had never existed before in the Torah, a love marriage. Not that Sarah and Abraham did not have tremendous love for each other. Of course they did, unequivocal love. But the first time the Torah talks about a love relationship, it's in the context of Isaac falling in love and marrying Rebecca. So what happens when Rebecca is barren for 20 years, 20 long suffering years? She implores Isaac, let's pray together. Isaac stands on one side of the room, Rebecca on the other, and they are granted a lovely son named Jacob. Unfortunately, Jacob comes with his alter ego, Esau, so it's not such a great package. But at least on half of the project, it worked out really well, swimmingly well, for Rebecca and for Isaac. Now, Rebecca Rivka is given information before the twins are born about the nature of who Jacob, Yaakov, will be, and who Esau is going to be. And how does she get this information? She goes to the yeshiva of Shem and Aver, and she consults with the son of Noah, who is still alive. He's a very old man. He's an antediluvian, therefore the normal constraints of time don't apply to him. He lived a long, long time, hundreds and hundreds of years. So he goes to say to Shem, he says, help me here, Rebecca says. I have an insane son. Every time I walk by the beautiful synagogue, he's kicking like a karate champion that he wants to get born and go in and pray. He wants to daven in shul. But then the next block, we come past the house of Avodah Zarah, idol worship. And the same son starts kicking as if he wants to go to temple of idols, and worship idols. I don't understand. What do I have, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde? I have a crazy son. So, of course, she's giving the information that what? No. Shnei goyim bevitneich. You have two different distinct nations. You have twins, my love. And one is going to be dedicating his entire life to the pursuit of holy things and synagogues and praying to God. The other is going to be not such a good guy, who's going to be praying to his idols and consumed with the material things to be bought in this world. And that's going to be Esau, okay? But Rebecca is given this to the exclusion of Isaac. Isaac never is given a prophecy concerning his own progeny. It's given to the Jewish mother. So listen to what is said in source 2. And the Lord said to Rebekah, to Rivka, Shnei goyim bevitneich, two nations are in your womb, and two kingdoms will separate from your innards. One kingdom will become mightier than the other, and the elder will serve the younger. Now this is critical. Why? Because later, when Esau is about to be blessed by Isaac, because Isaac senses his own mortality, and he asks for Esau, his quote-unquote, Bechor, his firstborn, to come in to get the blessings, Rebekah's mortified. Now remember, Isaac doesn't know about this prophecy, that Esau's ultimately going to be subservient to Jacob at the end of times. He's not aware of this. So who has to orchestrate a way, a little theatrical production, to enable Jacob, the rightful beneficiary of these blessings that come from Abraham and Isaac? They should go to Jacob and not to Esau. Who has to step in? Rebecca, of course, Rivka. And we all know this famous story where she tells Jacob, you got to dress up, I'll make the food just like your dad loves. You'll go in, you'll pretend to be Esau, Esau your brother, you'll get the blessings. They cannot go to the wicked Esau. It's all Rebecca. All Rebecca. So we see that we had Sarah listen to her voice. Rebecca is uniquely told by God the vision for the Jewish people. But it's not enough just to have the vision. She acts. Oh my gosh. She shapes the future for our people. And of course, skip a generation. Jacob has to run away as a result of taking the blessings because the animosity of his brother Esau knows no limitations. And he goes to evil Uncle Laban's house. And of course, by the well, who does he meet there? Boom, Rachel by the well. Okay, so turn over, please. Page 2. Source number 3. And of course, what happens immediately, to use a little Walt Disney quote from, I believe it was Bambi, even though Bambi's not such a politically correct movie, he is Twitter-pated by the well. He falls madly in love with Rachel, and we know the story that Rachel had a very lonely, sad, beautiful sister who had weak eyes. Her name was Leah. She was equally beautiful as Rachel, but she cried with desperation to God, please, I don't want to marry the firstborn of Jacob and Rebecca. I can't marry Esau. And as a result of her prayers to God, God grants her Jacob. So Jacob ends up marrying both Leah first and then Rachel. But this creates a crazy dynamic because it's always Rachel who is the choice number one, and it's always Leah playing second fiddle. And this creates a very, very unsettling dynamic within the home of Jacob, as you can imagine. God is desperate for Jacob to wake up and say, you know, I have Rachel, she's phenomenal. But Leah also is equally phenomenal in her own way. She's a blessing to you also, Jacob. And so she gives Leah child upon child upon child. Rachel remains barren until Joseph comes on the scene. Now, what happens? Source 3. Reuven, the Bechor, the eldest of the 12 tribes of Israel, goes out in the days of the wheat harvest, it says in number 3, and this is from Genesis 30, and he found Dudaim. It's not clear what these Dudaim are. They're some type of flower or plant, something beautiful with a beautiful fragrance. And he picks them in the field, and he brings them to his mom Leah as a gift. Beautiful. Firstborn son bringing Leah a gift. And Rachel says to Leah, oh my gosh, those are gorgeous flowers, gorgeous Dudaim. Now give me some of your son's Dudaim. Leah is not happy with this request from Rachel. And I don't like the fact that he used pronouns, but she, Leah, said to her, Rachel, is it a small matter that you have taken my husband? Meaning, the love of Jacob belongs to you, Rachel, not to me, Leah says. And you wish also to take my son's Dudaim, the love of my child? What? And so Rachel said, she understood the situation, listen to the sensitivity of Rachel. Therefore, he, Jacob, shall sleep with you tonight as payment for your son's Dudaim. You get my night with my husband because of the payment for the Dudaim, these flowers, this plant that was given to me from your son. You get Jacob for an extra night. So what happened? This, as insane as this is, look at the next line. So when Jacob came home from the field in the evening, Leah came forth towards him. She was all far-pitched. It's all dressed up. And she says to him, this is crazy, right? I mean, look what she says. You shall come to me, not to Rachel, in other words, because I have hired you with my son's Dudaim. Wow. And that's not enough, right? Listen to what happened. He slept with her on that night. And then God says, you know what? If it's good enough for Rachel to give a blessing to Leah, I listen to the ladies. So, and God hearkened to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. And Leah said, God has given me my sechar, my reward, for I have given my maidservant to my husband. Zilpah was her maidservant. So she named her fifth son Yisachar. Yisachar. Oh my gosh. I mean, it's a little bizarre story, correct? But look at this. I mean, Jacob, it's Mr. Patriarch, Yaakov Avinu, right? Jacob, the father of the Jewish people, who gets the name Israel when he defeats the angel of Esau in battle. And of course, he's the man in charge, right? Really? His wives are playing a little game. Well, who gets to be with the husband tonight? Essentially, Jacob is just going to give a child to somebody. So it could be Rachel, it could be Leah. Who's making the decisions in the family here? Of course, it's a patriarchal religion, as we're all falsely told, right? It's written by men. It's all about the ladies. The guy's like, he's just totally like, okay, which tent do I go to? Oh, I go to her. You made a decision? Fine. And then God says, whatever the women decide, so shall it be, right? So you have Sarah. Boom. Shema Bekola. Listen to Sarah, Mr. Abraham. You're the founding father of the Jewish people? Yes. She's your founding father. You better listen. Number two, it's Rebecca, Rivka. She's the one orchestrating the little theatrical production. Who will get the blessings? Who will be the Israel of our future? Not Esau, it's going to be Jacob. All done by Rebecca, who for my mind is almost like the quintessential Jewish mother. Right? Just saying, this is what's going to happen. Dad is blind, both metaphorically and literally, to who Esau is. So it's got to be Jacob, not Esau. And then we skip a generation, and we have Rachel and Leah deciding where are the children going to come from? Who will the children be? It's all about the ladies. Okay, now you might say, okay, but it's limited in its effect. This is just the origins of the Jewish people. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. What about more modern application in terms of the Torah, the Bible? Oh, I'm glad you asked. So let's go weiter. Let's skip from the book of Genesis and go to the book of Exodus, right? Where we are right now. We're about to celebrate the Exodus from Egypt next week. So let's talk about the Exodus. So source 4. So you have a situation where the Jewish people are enslaved to Yul Brynner, known as Pharaoh. Okay? He wasn't Ramses. He was really Yul Brynner. Okay? Yeah. I think Yul Brynner, my line is, if Pharaoh Ramses had ever seen Yul Brynner play him, he would have probably had him as a body double, and then he could have retired to Bermuda, you know, let Yul Brynner take the gig. That's how good Yul Brynner was, you know? So shall it be written, so shall it be done. Now, Pharaoh makes a decree. All Jewish baby boys, done. But before he makes the decree, he has a plan. First, let's subjugate the Jewish people, the men, with slavery. Let's minimize the danger that they may pose down the road to my country of Egypt. That doesn't work, though. And it doesn't work specifically because of the women, you know? Because what happened? The rabbis say at the end of the day, when the husbands were coming back from the field, they were tired beyond words. They're getting up at 5 a.m. The heat of Egypt, the desert, and they're just working back-breaking labor, and they're just too tired to do anything. And the women would come out, and I'm not going to get, you know, into the whole story, but suffice it to say, they would come, and they would have perfumes, and they would bathe, and they would look at the mirror, and they would play little games, who's more beautiful than whom, and they would, you know, get their husbands interested in them, and then they would have children. And that's how it happened. Those are what we call the righteous women, the Nashim Tzikonios, the righteous women. Now, what happened? Two young ladies, we don't know who they are. One's not so young, actually, when we actually know her real identity. One is named Shifra, and one is named Pua. But we're not actually told their real identities. These are a little euphemism. Actually, Shifra is none other than Yocheved, future mother of Moses, and Aaron, and Miriam. And this little girl named Pua, who's actually Miriam, the little daughter who's already born. And the two of them are the midwives, the nurses. They're the RNs of Egypt, of the Jewish population, the registered nurses, like Mrs. Kornblatt. And what happened? Pharaoh decides, I'm going to be complicit with these two women. So he goes to them and says, look, when you're helping the women give birth, I want you to look upon the birthing stool. If it's a male, secretly make sure he doesn't survive. If it's a female, it's okay. Of course, what happens? Let's read. Number 4. Now the king of Egypt, Pharaoh, spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one who was named Shifra, the second who was named Pua. And Pharaoh said, when you deliver the Hebrew women and you see on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall put him to death. But if it is a daughter, she may live. The midwives, however, feared God. So they did not do as the king of Egypt had spoken to them, but they enabled the boys to live. Not only did Shifra and Pua, Yocheved, mother of Moses, Aaron, and Miriam herself not listen to Pharaoh, disobeyed a direct command from the king of the world, But they actually went out of their way to keep the boys alive because they feared that if, God forbid, even one child doesn't make it, accusations will be slung against us that somehow we were complicit in the death of this baby. So they dove into God. They prayed to God, please, it's not enough. The normal birth rate and survival rate. But every child had to live. And that's exactly what happened in their merit. Shifra and Pua are the quintessential righteous women of that generation. Now, let's go weiter. Onward. The men themselves were crushed by Pharaoh. The slavery, the edict against the Jewish boys being thrown into the Nile, that was it. The greatest rabbi, a man, of course, of that generation, Amram, publicly divorces Shifra, his wife Yocheved. And every other male said, well, if it's good enough for the Rosh Yeshiva, for the head of the rabbis, it's good enough for me. So everyone was estranged from their spouse. And little five-year-old Pua, Miriam, goes to her dad. It's an amazing conversation. A little five-year-old child. She says, Dad, you're worse than Pharaoh. I'm worse than Pharaoh? Dear, what do you mean, sweetie? Well, you know, Pharaoh said, no baby boys, kill them. But by you divorcing mom, not only will there not be boys, there won't be girls, there won't be anybody. It'll be the death of our people. So Amram, the rabbi, starts to process what his little daughter said. And he says, you know what? Oh my gosh, you're right. And he remarries Yocheved publicly. And they, of course, give birth to someone named Moses? Moshe? The savior of the Jewish people. All from a vision of a Miriam who stands guard by the water as her little baby brother is in the basket, right? All supplied by Miriam. Miriam, the five-year-old, sees what the head rabbi, the most scholarly man, a great, great tzaddi, someone who the rabbis say never committed a real sin in his whole life. Amram couldn't see it. But it was so obvious to little five-year-old Miriam that she expresses it to her father, and remarkably her father was able to accept it. Amazing. So I ask you again to think, who's really in charge of the Jewish people? Now Pharaoh understood the mindset of a man. You see, I'll have a little secret here. There's not too many men here, but I'll tell you a secret. You already know this, ladies, okay? When it comes to us, we're very reliant on what they call das, a certain male ability to see things with to process it with sort of a design on it will go from A to B to C, and it'll wind up at Z. We're very, very linear in our thinking, and it has to sort of make sense each step of the road. Guys have an amazing inability to deal with life's curveballs. That's why women are such fabulous multitaskers. Very often men, and I'm speaking myself personally, we're not so good at multitasking. You know, one task enough, and if too many curveballs get thrown at me, too many unexpected things happen, very often men get a little crushed and a little emotional, like, oh my gosh, I'm overwhelmed. The stress, the pressure, what happened here? Well, you know, I got unexpected things. I woke up this morning thinking life was going to work out this way, but then phone calls came and unexpected developments, and I can't handle it. I don't know how to deal with this. Because men think a different way than women. You know this already. But how do women think? And this is where Pharaoh made a mistake, you see. Pharaoh, at every step of the way, understood the mindset of the men, because he was a man. But he underestimated the women, to the point where he felt he could play little games with Yocheved and Miriam, and, you know, he would seduce them with words, and they would listen, they would kill the babies, and it would all work. Really, Pharaoh? That's the best you can do? You think that the women are going to just roll over because you're the king of Egypt and acquiesce to your pernicious design? Really? And he worked as far as the men. Because think about it. Even the head rabbi was crushed by Pharaoh's plan to the point where he divorces his wife. So he got it perfectly correct when it came to the men of the Jewish population. What about the women? No. Pharaoh, you totally didn't get it when it came to the women. Because what do women rely upon? So you've all heard this expression. We call it bina yetera. Bina yetera. This extra ability to see what's not even there. To not focus on the little details that come up in life, but to see sort of what we call a big picture, a shoresh. At the end, there's a goal. I don't know how I'm going to get to the goal, but as long as I retain that vision in front of me for what will be, I'll get there. I don't exactly know how. And if you ask me today, how will I go from here to that vision? I don't know. I just know that that is where my belief, my nemanut, my belief, my faith, I trust that I will get there at some point in time. So you can throw slavery, infanticide, every nightmarish thing that Pharaoh threw at the Jewish population of Egypt. What was the response of the men? There's no future. We're dead. We're finished. Just give up. Right? They gave up. What was the response of the women? You're going to give up? Really? Life will find a way. Miriam saying to her dad, you're going to divorce mom and kill the women and the men? I don't know what it's going to mean, Miriam says to her father, but I do know that your act de facto means we're done. So you get back together with mom. I don't know how life will go on. How could she know that there'll be a little boy named Moses who's going to come and save the Jews? She doesn't know this. It's going to be her own little brother that she's going to create. She doesn't know. It didn't matter to Miriam. All she knew was what? At the end, I believe that God will remember his people. It'll work out in the end. Now, that's an amazing thing. It's so amazing that have a look at source number 5. That when the Jewish people finally get out of Dodge, out of Egypt, out of Mitzrayim, and they come to the Red Sea, and they cross through miraculously the sea splitting, and we all have a beautiful, beautiful poem that's part of the liturgy that we sing every morning. Az Yashir Moshe Uvnei Israel. That Moses led the men in a song to praise God, right? But if you look carefully at the end of the song, the women started to sing also. Only their song was a little better than the men's song. How so? We'll have a look at number 5. Miriam Hanaviah, Miriam the prophetess, Aaron's sister, took a timbrel, like a little noisemaker, like a drum in her hand. And all the women came out after Miriam with timbrels and with dances. And Miriam called out to them, sing to the Lord, just like we say with Shir LaShem, sing out to God. Ki ga'ah ga'ah, for he very exalted is God. Sus v'rachbo, a horse and its rider, he cast into the sea. It's the end of the song, by the way. The men began, the women end. Now I have a question for you. Where in the world did the women get the drums, the timbrels? Was there like a Wilkes-Barre music rental shop there by the Red Sea? They just said, okay, dear, you sing your song and we're going to go rent some instruments to accompany our song. The men just sang. The women sang and had musical instruments. Where did they get them from? So you know what Rashi says? Look at number 6. Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, the quintessential commentator on our Torah, tells us something amazing, and this cuts to the heart of what we're saying today. With timbrels and with dances, the righteous women, the Nashim Tikkoniot of that generation, were so certain that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be He, would perform miracles for them, they took timbrels out of Egypt. So not only are they carrying the matzah, the leftover matzah, and their supplies, whatever they can carry, they're stuffing drums and guitars and trombones into their backpacks. And if you would ask the women, the morning of their departure, right? This is Passover, the 15th day of Nisan, 2448. I know exactly the day. Literally, this happened. If you would ask, stop a woman and say, time out. Excuse me. You walk over, you say, excuse me, aren't you in a hurry to get out of here? Yes, we're moving really fast. You have all your possessions with you that you can carry. Yes. How come you have a trombone and a trumpet and this lady has a drum set? What's going on? I don't know. So then why are you schlepping it? Leave it! Come on, get out! No. I know that there's going to come a moment that I'm going to need these to show my love and gratitude to God. When will this be, you ask the young lady or the older lady. She'll say, what? I don't know when it's going to be. There'll be a moment. Really? Yeah. I just know that at some point I'm going to have to show my love to God, and I want an instrument to augment the feeling that I'm going to have, the passion. That's exactly what we're saying. That the women had an ability not to get the details, because that's really not relevant. They see the big picture, the goal, the vision. There will be a time of great redemption. And I'm going to need these instruments I can't tell you now what I need, but I just know I'll need it then. That is the greatness of the Jewish word. That's what you have. That's what our matriarchs had. Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, Leah, Miriam, Yocheved, all of them had this. Amazing. Now, what's more remarkable is that every time we got out of a difficult situation, we needed a geula, a redemption, it was always the women. Passover, look at source number 7. Passover, the greatest salvation yet. It says, Bischar, in the merit of the Nashim Tzikoniot, of the righteous women who were in that generation, Israel was redeemed from Egypt. Babylonian Talmud, Sota. Because of the women, of the Miriam, of the Yocheved, and every other anonymous woman, we don't even know who they were, who had the mirrors and who carried on the Pur Revuim, the being fruitful and multiplying and making sure that Jewish survival would be a reality. They were the reason, and they were the only reason that we've survived the nightmare of Egypt. But think of the other more, shall we say, current diasporas that we had and how they came to an end. Anybody ever heard of Hanukkah? You know who the heroine of Hanukkah was? Now you might say, well, the Maccabees, of course. You would be only partially right. Because there was a Maccabee young lady named Judith, actually a book written about her, Yehudit, Judith, who was the daughter of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. She's the one who got King Holofernes of the Greeks drunk, cut off his head, and started the entire revolution. It was a woman. That's why women don't do work when the Hanukkah candles are lit. They took it upon themselves because they were so instrumental in making Hanukkah become a reality. How about the holiday we just celebrated 2.5 weeks ago? What's that book called that we read on Purim? The book of... Oh, there's no Mordechai mentioned, right? It's Esther. It's all Esther. Every redemption of our people, it's always the women. It's never the men. So just to end today, I think we've shown very clearly, demonstrated that our Torah, not only does it not put women down, but to the discerning reader, every step of the way from Sarah all the way to the righteous women of the generation of Egypt, it was always the women who carried the torch for Jewish survival. And God willing, we have Bar Tzoras today with Israel, in Europe, and even a little bit in America. We're going to look to the ladies to help us with this geula, with this redemption at hand. And with God's help and with your vision, b'mheira b'yameinu, we should have a geula shlema, a redemption. This Passover should be the last Passover of the exile, as they say at the end of the Seder, that next year in Jerusalem. Shana haba Yerushalayim.